much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com, and right here with you on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., right here on PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knoll Station, and we are so happy to be a part of it. One of the great things about all the shows here on Progressive Radio Network is that you can tune in anytime at your convenience. All you have to do is go to PRN.FM and visit the archives. For this show, scroll down to N for Natural Nurse. And, of course, on the way, you'll see lots of other shows chock full of the best information which you can't find anywhere else right here on Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have as our guest Dave DeWitt. And Dave DeWitt is a food historian, and he's an expert on chili peppers, spices, and spicy foods. He has actually authored more than 40 books as a prolific writer, mostly on food and gardening. And David has appeared on major stations such as CNN, The Today Show, CBS Sunday Morning, The Martha Stewart Show, and has been featured in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Los Angeles Times, USA Today, The Smithsonian, and more than 200 newspapers across the country. And today he is our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we will be talking about his book called Growing Medical Marijuana. Wow. A topic whose time has come, and he'll be outlining the ins and outs of marijuana cultivation in the states in which it's legal, of course. And this guy also presents easy-to-master approaches to fertilizing, pruning, controlling pests, maximizing flower production, cloning, producing your own seeds, and more. And to find out more after today's show, go to www.dave-dewitt.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, yes. We finally talk on the air.
Yes, it sounds good. It sounds good. Now, let's go back in time and talk about what got you interested in gardening and made that so much a part of your life and your writing.
Well, my brother and I were the grunts of the family in terms of gardening, in the sense that we did all the grunt work when we were growing up. And it started when I was 8 and my brother was 4. And we were the ones who took care of the compost pile. We screened the dirt. My father had a special formula that was a mix of sand and compost and, everything that would make good, soil to grow things in. My father was an avid tomato grower. My mother entered tulips and flower shows. And so I grew up with it, and I've always had a garden, except when I, of course, there was a few years when I was in college and lived in, dorm rooms and apartments where I couldn't. But other than that, I have a garden every year, and I just love to grow things, and then I love to eat the things that I grow in the garden.
Tell us more about where was that?
This is in Northern Virginia. I grew up in Northern Virginia.
Beautiful, prolific, biodiverse area with great soil.
Yeah, it is. It is. Of course, I grew up next to a gigantic forest, which, of course, is now apartment buildings or something. And so I got to be in the woods, and there was all kinds of animals. I mean, we had bobcats and foxes and raccoons and never saw a bear, but... So I was a nature boy. That's what I was, and I sort of stuck with me. I'm still a birder, and I like to experiment with growing different kinds of crops and that sort of thing. We should set your readers straight. I do not grow medical marijuana, and the reason I don't grow medical marijuana is, one, I don't have a license to do it in the state of New Mexico, and the second reason is I don't have adequate security, and the subtitle of my book is Securely and Legally. In other words, growing medical marijuana securely and legally, and if I can't grow it securely, I'm not going to grow it. And the security situation is not so much hiding it from raids by the narcs these days. It's more that if you have a plant that's worth $1,000, it'd be very tempting for someone to steal.
Boy, I never even thought about that, because we have that that problem even with naturally occurring plants such as ginseng, like
yes.
wild ginseng. What a lot of people will do, will go around and take off the berries, because it's very hard to find a ginseng plant unless you really know what you're doing. I wildcraft all the time. But the thing that signals in the fall is these red berries on the bottom. And if you don't have those, it's a little bit hard to find. But people do come and steal it.
Yep. And there's, of course, people will steal your tomatoes, but they won't go through a lot of trouble to do that. I have, you know, a 6-foot cinder block wall around the backyard, and there's no alley in back of it. So there is some security, but not, there's enough security for a regular garden, but certainly not for a marijuana garden.
Is New Mexico a legal state, a legal
yes.
growing state? Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so that's something you could consider if you then put, like, I don't know what, electronic surveillance on your
wall
or something.
You can do that, and then you have to worry all the time, you know. And I'm not into worrying. And the reality is, if you want marijuana, there's so much of it around now. I've never seen so much of it, and the prices are dropping so fast because the state directly to our north has legalized, Colorado has legalized marijuana for recreational use. So, good grief. This could be flooding across the borders. As a matter of fact, I've heard that cars with Colorado license plates are regularly pulled over for no reason by police in neighboring states, hoping to, you know, make an arrest. That wouldn't happen so much in New Mexico, but it would in other places where it's not been, like Kansas, for example, where it is not legal yet. And it's interesting because there's 19 states in the District of Columbia where there's some degree of legalization for marijuana now, and that is getting
is
approaching
that true?
Half.
Wait a minute. That,
yeah.
I would like you to repeat that, because that's news to me. And one of the reasons I like to do radio all these years is because it teaches me new things, and I never heard that factoid. Could you repeat it?
Well, I think the number is 19 states and the District of Columbia, it's just... this is out of the bag. It's not going back in the bag. I mean, the marijuana cat is out of the bag. It's legal in Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, Maine, Michigan, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. And there's a couple more that have happened since this book was written.
Legal, I mean, there's various levels of legality.
Yes.
So what do you
yes.
mean by that?
Legal in some extent. In other words, mostly for medical use, provided you have a note from a doctor, but not a prescription, because it's against federal law to issue a prescription for marijuana, and doctors would not want to lose, you know, a license because of that. But they make a recommendation is what it is. It's not a prescription. It's just a recommendation that this person needs it, and they fill out a little form, which is different in every state, of course. And all this conflicts with federal law. I mean, the states here are doing a states' rights thing from the grassroots. Ha ha ha! You see, that's what's happening. Is the states are telling giving the big middle finger to the federal government, saying we can do whatever we want in our state.
Well, you know, recently I was in Colorado because I travel to lecture on holistic medicine all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was visiting a friend who had a beautiful store where he sold energy medicine devices in, I think it was Loveland. It was outside of the main city, a
right.
beautiful country area. And in the same shopping center that his store is, was the first time I ever had seen a dispensary, which is just like a store in a strip mall that you just walk in.
Yep.
So I went in there just to see what it was about, because I've never seen that before. We don't have them in New York. You didn't list New York on that legal state at all. And Florida.
It's right around the corner.
No, most likely. And so I live in New York and Florida and Arizona. We don't have
right.
those little stores in any of those states. So I walked in and I was amazed. There was actually a doctor sitting there, you know, in a little booth. And
uh-huh.
you could go up and, I guess, pay him some kind of fee. And tell him, you got to say something like, your back hurts. I don't know.
Right,
you know,
right.
And it really wasn't for recreational use. That's not what they're selling it for. It was for, you know, like you say, quasi-medical use. And it was just a whole store, just open like that. Now, I've heard some of those places do get raided by federal agents. Is that true?
They do when their behavior is regarded as egregious. In other words, when they're overstepping, or the feds are just trying to make an example of them. But there's going to be little the feds can do about this. It remains a Schedule III narcotic, which means that marijuana, which has never killed a human being in existence, is classified with heroin and cocaine, right up there with the big bad boys that are addictive, whereas marijuana, of course, is not addictive, not in a physical sense anyway. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, depending on, you know, how the ridiculous war on drugs goes, which has been a total bust, so to speak. And it's fascinating. This whole story is evolving. And that's why I like it so much. It's evolving. And the reason I wrote the book, Growing Medical Marijuana, was for money. However, I saw that there was a need for an uncomplicated book. I mean, there are books that are 550 pages long about how to grow medical marijuana that have every possible thing, like page after page after the specifications of the number of lumens and intensity of light of 53 different bulbs you can use in grow bulbs, you know, in indoor gardening. I mean, I don't think that's just information overkill. That should be a reference book on your shelf if you should ever need it, not one to guide some people who have never grown anything before, like Leo in my book. He had never even grown a houseplant before he decided to get a license and grow marijuana. And he's a good friend of mine, so he trusted me and I trusted him. And it was a coincidence that I got the book deal right at the same time he was starting his first crop. And so we followed his entire cycle through the entire year, what he did right, what he did wrong. Yes, I did advise him on a number of things. He would call me up in a panic and say, there's little spider webs all over my plant. And I'd say, spider mites, you're going to have to destroy that plant. And
right.
That was very, very sad for him. But you know, when you've been gardening as long as I do have been, you note things like if you see these little white dots on the top of the leaf, this tells you to turn the leaf over and see if they're spider mites, because that's where they grow. They hide. They're underneath the leaves, and then until a population gets so big that they take over the whole damn plant. But they start underneath the leaves,
but
protecting
you start
themselves
the evidence through the kind of a spider web evidence.
Yeah. Right.
Now,
and
it's
so,
very interesting in your book, too, because you talk about the long history of marijuana in the United States. For instance, we have a town here in New York called Hempstead.
Yes.
And you probably know the history of it. If you do, you can share that. But it was actually a very big marijuana field back in the historic times.
Well, of course, because before sisal became the primary plant to make rope out of, it was cannabis. I mean, hemp fields were for the riggings and all the lines and ropes that were used aboard all the sailing ships that went out of New England. I mean, that was why the sailing ships were so powerful and so great. They had all this rope, and, you know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, they all grew hemp. There was nothing wrong with hemp. They weren't smoking it. They were growing it for commercial use, for the fiber, not for the psychoactive properties. So, but it's the same plant. It's just a different variety. I mean, it's like there's different varieties of corn, there's different varieties of tomatoes, as we all know, and there's different varieties of the same species, cannabis sativa in this particular case, which is what the fiber comes from. So it was a noble plant, and now it's completely illegal even to grow hemp in the United States, but of course it's completely legal in Canada.
Right. And there has been a resurgence of hemp products tremendously. I mean, in the health food store, I'm in the health food industry with Nature's Answer, and we you know, see all the time that protein powders made from hemp are being widely marketed.
Right. And you know, the crazy thing is that I'm chair of the board of the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum, and so I go down every quarter to Las Cruces and chair the board meeting. And when the book came out, there's a little bit of discussion about it, obviously, because I go to these things and people would say, "Hi, Dave, what's your new book like?" And I'd show them the medical marijuana, and they just almost faint because they were expecting me to have another Chili Pepper book. And so I talked to some of the people on my board who are Chili Pepper farmers and other kinds of farmers too. One grows forage for cows and so forth over in Roswell. This is undramatic stuff. And I asked them, you know, if hemp were legalized, would you grow it? And they said no, because there's no market established for it. In other words, the hemp market for clothing and so forth is so small compared to what it was when it was used for making lines and rope and all that kind of stuff that there really is. It's probably the people who need it would probably get it cheaper by importing it from Canada rather than trying to get farmers to grow it, although it's very easy to grow.
Well, as you say, and you do point out in your book, Growing Medical Marijuana Securely and Legally, it's a beautiful book with a big picture of a nice leaf on the cover. It's very, very easy, as you say. It's easily outlined. And you do talk about, in the introduction, the fact that it has been used so long, you know, throughout history, and it's really like it's an annual weed, basically, a plant species.
That's it. I mean, there are ways to kill it. Let the pests get it, like spider mites. Don't drain your pots so the roots suffocate because they can't get oxygen. Those are good ways to do it. There's plenty of ways to kill them, but you know, marijuana is one of the few crops in existence which was domesticated, but it escapes from domestication all the time, whereas corn does not escape from domestication. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Tomatoes don't. I mean, in other words, yeah, you might find a volunteer tomato every now and then, but it's rare. And you hardly ever find a volunteer corn plant. But you find marijuana plants growing everywhere. I mean, they grow in Kentucky wild hemp from
the days they had hemp fields there. They're not particularly strong in terms of THC content.
No, they're not. As a matter of fact, the levels are very, very low, and you probably can't even get a buzz just smoking hemp. But still, it's the same plant, so in the eyes of the government, it's illegal. I mean, the federal government, that is. So it's an interesting situation.
It really is. Now, let me ask you one other thing in terms of the legality, sure. And even let's just say Colorado, for instance, mm-hmm. since that was my experience of walking into this mall store, which apparently my son tells me in Seattle are all over the place.
Sure.
Just like Dunkin' Donuts or something that is mm-hmm. there. Now, what is the federal taxing situation on these things? I mean, are these guys paying sales tax when they make these sales?
Well, they're only paying state sales tax.
Okay, so they're paying state sales tax on their business.
Yeah, but they're not paying any federal tax at all.
Well, what about on the income that they're generating as their personal income by owning the store?
They pay federal income tax.
Okay.
I mean, but I'm not. I thought you were talking about a narcotic tax.
No, not a narcotic tax, but I'm just saying that the government actually is making money on this business, you know, even through the person's income.
Well, right? The IRS doesn't care anything about where the income comes from.
Okay.
They don't care. I mean, prostitutes regularly file income tax returns
and
list their profession as prostitution, where it's legal, in
Nevada or something. See,
yeah.
I never even thought about that. That's fascinating, too. So the government is already making money on this as a venture, as a business venture, both the state governments, who, of course, sorely need it, and the federal government is also making money if that's a person's business. So,
yeah, and then that's not hypocritical at all.
That's interesting. So basically,
yeah.
that's of course going on. Whereas if it's completely underground, you know, let's say either your large scale drug sales importer or your small town, let's say drug promoter, even on the street level selling joints, for a few dollars, they're not paying taxes on that money.
No, no.
So
and
therefore,
and, you know,
more of the money is being filtered towards the government when it is legal.
Well, in the eyes of the government, they're criminals, and criminals aren't supposed to pay taxes, and when criminals pay taxes, what a surprise.
Now, however, though, what is this legality doing to those underground businesses?
Well, it's threatening them, and that's the big problem, is a lot, you know, California defeated the same kind of law that was passed in Washington and Colorado, and the reason it was defeated was because of the underground marijuana growers in Northern California all against it, all against legalization. And
because
it would put them out of business.
Oh, they couldn't then sell it legally?
Well, they could, but if you're growing it yourself for fun, why would you buy somebody else's?
Okay.
So they're afraid that anybody will be allowed, just like in Colorado, to grow a certain number of plants per year without regard to any medical necessity. It's just for fun. And there would be no need for commercial marijuana farms and regulation and all that kind of stuff. There's no need for it. So California has opposed that, even though, you know, most people believe that marijuana should be at least as legal as alcohol. I mean, remember, marijuana has never directly killed anybody, unlike alcohol, heroin, you know, cigarettes, you know, you could name it. Those are all legal and regulated, and they're legal and regulated on a federal level as well as a state level. So why not marijuana? I mean,
well, yeah, there's all kinds of reasons, you know, in terms of the absurdity. So it's actually nice to see that growing marijuana legally, securely and legally, which is the name of your book, you know, is something we actually can openly talk about. And we are doing so today. And we're going to just take a little break right here.
All right.
Into the Natural Medicine Chest. And when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion with the author of Growing Medical Marijuana Securely and Legally, Mr. Dave DeWitt. We'll be right back with more here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
And thank you for joining us once again right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And are you there again?
Yes, I am.
Very good, Dave. I want to reintroduce you. And listeners, we're talking today with author Dave DeWitt, a prolific author. And he has written many books on chili peppers, spices, and spicy foods, which I'm going to ask you about a little bit as well. And he has authored actually more than 40 books about this, and he has appeared on major media all over the country. And on today's show, we are focusing on a specific book that he wrote called Growing Medical Marijuana, which outlines the ins and outs of marijuana cultivation in the states in which it's legal. And this guide also presents easy-to-master approaches to fertilizing, pruning, controlling pests, maximizing flower production, cloning, producing your own seeds, and more. And you can find the book, of course, on Amazon.com, just putting Growing Medical Marijuana, or on Dave's site, dave-dewitt, dewitt.com, or visit the archives right here on Progressive Radio Network, because if you find this show interesting, any of your friends can listen to it anytime by visiting the archives at prn.fm and going to N for Natural Nurse and then look for today's show. It will be posted there. So thank you so much for being our guest. And let's backtrack a little bit, Dave. Tell us a little bit about your fascination with spicy foods and why you've written so many books about that.
Well, what happened was I had no experience with spicy foods at all until I moved to New Mexico in 1974. And chili peppers are beloved here. I mean, it's one of our state vegetables, even though chili peppers are not a vegetable, they're a fruit. And the other one is pinto beans. And, of course, they're not a vegetable either. They're a legume. And so we have two state vegetables, neither one of which is a vegetable. However, it certainly is the state plant, no matter what anybody wants to call it. It's, you know, a fruit eaten like a vegetable, like an avocado is.
Think about it, so are tomatoes and cucumbers.
Yeah, exactly. So when I moved here, all of a sudden I was thrown into a world where the food in New Mexico revolves around chili peppers. I mean, they're served almost at every meal in a lot of families. And people in the fall or in late summer and early fall, they buy 40 pounds of pods in a burlap sack, have them roasted, and then they take them home and peel them and chop them up and put them in the freezer like we do every year. And you see the long strings called ristras of red chilies hanging on, you know, from people's front porches and so forth like that. That's a traditional sign of welcome. In New Mexico, you see a chili pepper or a ristra everywhere. Their logos, lots of companies use them for logos and symbols and all that kind of stuff. And we were, for quite a while, the number one producer of chili peppers in the country. And it was our number one food crop for a long time. But in New Mexico, the chili acreage has dropped a lot. Other states are picking up the slack, and Mexico is picking up some slack. And so we think that New Mexico now grows about 40% of all the chilies in the U.S., something like that, when before it grew about 60%. So, but the other places that grow them are growing New Mexican varieties that were developed at New Mexico State University. So It really doesn't matter whether a chili pepper is grown in Chihuahua, Mexico, or Las Cruces, New Mexico. I mean, remember, we used to be a part of Mexico here. So we were the northernmost province of Mexico, as a matter of fact. And when
that's why you have that, you know, a very Mexican feeling about both the food, the culture, the architecture.
Right. And so it's so beloved here that I just got fascinated with it. And I started trying to find information about it, and information was scarce. I mean, you could find a cookbook put out by the public service company, which is our electric provider here. They had a cookbook on, you know, chili peppers in New Mexico cuisine or something like that. But I couldn't find much more than that kind of thing. And I started reading about it and researching, and all of a sudden I realized, well, this is just part of a phenomenon that is actually worldwide. And we started collecting recipes, and I met a recipe developer, Nancy Gerlach, and she had a similar love of chili peppers. And I thought, well, why don't we try to write a book on the subject? And so we put together a proposal and sent it to a number of agents, and an agent picked it up, and it was about chili peppers in worldwide cuisine. And so we called it The Fiery Cuisines. And that was published in, I think, 1980, when did that thing come out? It was early. It was like 1984, I think. And it was in hardcover. And then they sold a British edition of it. And then it went into many paperback editions, and was very popular. And then I just went on a kick of writing chili pepper books with Nancy Gerlach mostly, and we tried to cover everything we could think of. We did, you know, chili pepper cuisine of Mexico. We did the Asian, Southeast Asian chili cuisine. We did, I did The Pepper Garden, a gardening book on it with Dr. Paul Boslin down at New Mexico State University. We did a field guide. We did a health book called The Healing Powers of Peppers. And it just went on and on and on, and for a while there, any proposal I wrote up would be accepted and published. Now, of course, I've written most of them, and that's why I'm writing about medical marijuana and other things that I'm interested in, because I, after Paul and I came out 2.5 years ago with the complete chili pepper book, that's still in hardcover, it sells so well, there wasn't much more we can do on this subject. I mean, as far as a national level goes. And so I started branching out, and marijuana was an interest that I've had for a long time. Fortunately, 10 Speed Press out there in Berserkly liked it a lot. So I did 10 books with them previously. It hadn't had a book published by them in many years, but they liked the medical marijuana book.
It's a great book, and that's the one we're talking about today, Growing Medical Marijuana Securely and Legally. And, of course, in the book, you go into the real details of growing. And let's talk a little bit about seeds, because I will tell you that I lived on a farm in Arizona for many, many years, and I'll tell you what we did then. And we actually raised rabbits. And so we had a house, like a rabbit house. It was an inside rabbit house. You didn't have to heat it. You know, it was Arizona, way up in the mountains, actually, in Bisbee, Arizona, where I still have this farm. And it's a fabulous place, not too far from New Mexico. We'd go there to the hot springs all the time. And we actually had a rabbit house, and then under the rabbits was a big box all in the center. The rabbits were on the outside. And then, of course, as the rabbits go to the bathroom, the feces just falls to the floor, which rabbit feces is excellent fertilizer. You do not have to cure it like you have to do with chicken and other animals where it may be hot.
It's very high nitrogen.
High nitrogen, easy to work with, really odor-free, and does not burn plants. So it was great. So we used to just pile it right into the center. And then what we decided to do to add an income potential, because this was a farm, was to raise earthworms within the rabbit droppings. And that worked out really, really well, because people who go fishing, you know, they go up to the mountainous lakes like in Patagonia and stuff, you know, and all kinds of reasons. People had raised garden beds because the soil in Arizona is pretty hard. And then we came up with the idea of adding another cash crop to that mix. And we did choose marijuana at the time, which definitely was not legal in Arizona, and I think it's still not legal in Arizona, so I don't know if I can be
post-arrested. Legal for medical use. It's legal for medical use now.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so we grew it for medical use back in the 70s. Anyway, and so we did really find out a lot about the things that you're talking about in this book just through trial and error, and we were looking for a book like this at the time. But I know that one of the things we wanted to grow, because it was something that gleaned a higher income potential, was sin semilla, which
right.
in Spanish means without seed. And then
exactly.
you have a chapter also with, you want also to have some seeds. So let's talk about those two things, growing it without seed and then producing your own seeds.
Well, it's just like mulberry trees. Marijuana plants have sexes. There are male plants and female plants. The male plants provide the pollen. And the female plants, of course, produce the seeds from the pollen. So all you have to do to have sensimilla is get rid of all the male plants.
Right, and just means without, right.
Yeah, and so when you start seeing the male flowers develop, you cut down those plants, and then you have all female plants, and they will not be fertilized and turned to seed. And so they keep producing the flowers, and the flowers contain resin, which, of course, is psychoactive. And that just keeps on going. And the plants get these what are called colas. Cola is Spanish for tail, meaning like a foxtail, a big bushy flower top that the growers these days call buds. Well, anyone who knows anything about botany knows that a bud is the beginning of a flower, not the end of a flower. So it's completely a misnomer. I refuse to use that term for a finished flowering top. I just use flowering top instead of bud.
Why is that? Why? Tell us what, why.
It's the slang is not just slang, just not some word you picked out of the blue that has no relation to anything. It's a botanical term that's used incorrectly, and I won't do that in a book.
Okay, very good reason. Okay.
I mean, I was an English major. I have a master's degree in English. That's why
when I'm talking about hops, I always talk about hops phallus, which is the correct term,
Mm-hmm.
It's a phallus,
sure.
So it's not a bite of something. Yeah, so that's a good reason.
Anyway, so you have these large flowering tops that have to be cured and then dried. The curing is merely getting rid of the chlorophyll, just like tobacco would be cured. So, I mean, this is nothing new, but it makes the marijuana smoke much better and not give you the cough that sometimes is associated with smoking marijuana. Not that I've ever done that. And so I did the same thing you did in my youth. I grew it illegally and never got caught and that is what gave me the idea to base this book around security, because I knew people who had got caught. And it's not a pleasant thing for that to happen. The whole process of growing marijuana, whether it's outdoors or indoors, is simple. The challenges are, it comes down to security, just like I said a few minutes ago. If you have, and they grow this big, if you have an 18-foot-tall marijuana plant in your backyard, it's going to look like a tree. But it's going to look like a marijuana tree. And everybody knows what marijuana looks like these days. So that's not really secure. So you have to prune and trim back and keep these things within reason. That's why a lot of the amateur marijuana growers have developed varieties, and they were amateurs, but most of the rose varieties in this country were developed by amateurs. So we have to give amateurs a lot of credit for coming up with some things. And what they're calling varieties are really interspecific hybrids. They're not true varieties that breed true all the time. They're mostly
so they're hybrids that people develop, let's say, to use short
right.
bush-like plants.
Right, and of course, chili peppers have these kinds of hybrids, too. Many tomato plants are hybrids, and hybrids tend to have a vigor. When you cross two different varieties and you get a hybrid, you have a vigorous plant, and that's what they're trying to do. And so there's thousands of supposed marijuana varieties out there, and the seeds are very expensive. And most of the people who grow illegally order their seeds from either the UK or the Netherlands. And sometimes the seeds can cost as much as, $10 a piece.
Why would they order it from there versus, let's say, Mexico or somewhere?
Well, there's no seed banks in Mexico that are producing seeds. And these are professional seed banks that have developed stealth ways to send the seeds and various ways of disguising them so that the packages are not open. And if the packages are open, they are merely confiscated. That's all that ever happens. In other words, it's a fairly safe thing to do. And then once you have those varieties, if you're careful and know what you're doing, you can produce your own seeds. You just have one section of your that's isolated where you have a male plant and some female plants, and you'll produce all the seeds you want. And some people do that and then sell the seeds for half what people are paying for them to get them from out of the country. And the more that this happens and the more, let's say, marijuana shows, these are trade and consumer shows that go around the country, having everything from power clippers and pruners, all kinds of gear. It's unbelievable if you look in, a marijuana magazine, for example, High Times is the most popular one, to see all the equipment. I mean, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. And when you have multi-billion-dollar industries, you're going to have all kinds of people involved in it. With legalization for recreational use now in Colorado and Washington, the whole thing is out of the bag. And the reason Washington did it and Colorado was to tax it.
Well, that's what I brought up earlier, right? There's reasons for it as well. And you're also going to save a lot of money on not having people, let's say, in jail who you have to feed for years.
Yeah, well, Washington State changed the liquor laws, and they let private people open liquor stores, which had never happened before. They were state stores, like Virginia still has, for example. In other words, the state controls all the sales of liquor, distilled beverages, in other words. And that was true in Washington, but they changed the law under some pressure from some distilleries, and so all the state liquor stores went vacant. And now guess what they're going to be?
Right, they're going to be
marijuana dispensaries. Yeah.
Well, hold
that thought,
Dave.
State-run marijuana.
That's amazing. We're going to come back to that thought, but we have another station identification break coming up right here, and we're going to hear from Progressive Radio Network about all the other fascinating shows that listeners can tune into or visit the archives and listen to anytime right here on PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back with more. And welcome back once again for more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I'd like to tell you, listeners, that if you go to naturalnurse.com and click schedule, you will see many of the events where you can join myself and co-host Dr. Eugene Zamperone on ground. That means doing stuff together in person rather than just virtually. And a couple of the very exciting adventures that are coming up are a tour of Chinatown, where we actually take a day and it feels like we were going to a completely different country. We do Qigong in the park. We do tongue and pulse diagnosis. We learn about Chinese herbs. So go to naturalnurse.com under schedule to find out more. Also, we have upcoming a very important event, which we have yearly, which is sponsored by University of Bridgeport and Stony Brook University, because I'm a clinical instructor at Stony Brook University and Dr. Zamperone is a professor at the University of Bridgeport, and the two schools are on board co-sponsoring the evidence-based natural Therapy Symposium. And last year we held it at Bridgeport. This year we're holding it at the University of Stony Brook. It is a one-day event. It offers 5 CEU credits, and it has excellent information. We are featuring this year as our lead speaker, Dr. Peter D'Adamo. You may know him from writing the book, Eat Right for Your Type, but he'll be speaking about epigenetics. And epigenetics is a fascinating study showing that regardless of what your genetic structure is, you can influence it through your lifestyle, food, exercise, and thought processes. You actually can learn to trigger your own genes in the direction that you want them to go. And we'll have other exciting speakers there. If you go to naturalnurse.com, there's a click-through to the full symposium day brochure. So that's a couple of the many, many things you can join in on right here through the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And today we have as our guest a fascinating person who's been sharing with us information from his book, Growing Medical Marijuana Securely and Legally. And thank you so much for being our guest today, Dave.
Oh, I'm enjoying it. I like it. This is fun.
This is Dave DeWitt. It is, and it's fun for me, too, because you know what? I love to learn, and I've heard some new things from you. So what we left off was that the government-run liquor stores are closing up because of the licensing agreements where now private individuals can sell liquor in a liquor store. And now, continue that thought that you were just sharing with us before break.
Well, I think it's ingenious, and these people knew what they were doing. I mean, they need money for schools. They need money for all kinds of things, and here you've got a desired substance that people want, and just like anything, and including food in many states, the government taxes what people want. They tax gasoline. They tax everything else. Why not tax marijuana? And so in order to tax it, of course, it has to be legal. You can't tax something that is illegal. So it made every sense in the world. I don't know how many stores are going to be converted, but I mean, I read a news report about this. I don't know that for absolute fact, but it makes
sense.
Wait, now
these stores are going to be government marijuana stores? Government-sponsored marijuana stores. Are they going to compete with, like, the store I went into in Colorado, which I imagine was just privately owned in a strip mall, or was that also a government store?
Well, it was a private store,
okay.
But it was regulated by the state
of
Colorado.
Okay.
And so that will still probably be happening, but nobody knows. This has never happened before. All people can do is make predictions. We don't really know what the result's going to be.
Well, I imagine, of course, it's going to be based on pricing. So if the government store can deeply discount, then it's going to put the privates out of business, I would imagine.
That would seem like that's what's going to happen. I mean, if you think about it logically, that would be apparently what's going to happen. Hey, if it's legal, it's legal.
Well, it depends on a lot of things. For instance, let's say the government store, you know, has a lower price, but the private stores have a better quality. I mean, just like now, there's Whole Foods and there's, you know, A&P or Safeway or something. They're both stores. They both offer food, but they have, you know, different pricing structures and different choices.
Well, we know that there are marketing methods that people can use. Is it grown organically? Or, of course, organic everything costs more than non-organic things. So it makes sense that people will go for the buzzwords that people want to hear, grown organically, or some new variety that's more potent, or some excuse to sell it for the price they want. Now, whether the government is going to use those kind of tactics to make sure that their prices are not undermined by individuals growing it at home is one thing. And, of course, just because it's legal to grow and possess does not mean it's legal to sell.
Exactly. And what about paraphernalia? Is that legal? You know, like pipes and all these fancy things they have nowadays, smokeless things.
Well, it's legal as long as they have not been contaminated by using marijuana in them, and so they don't have any traces of marijuana.
Right, but do you think a government store would also offer a paraphernalia section like these other stores do?
Yes. Sure. Huh. Why not? I mean, it's something else to sell.
I have to go to one just to laugh after all these years.
Oh, I know. It's just for people who are as old as I am anyway, this is just like a breath of fresh air. We never thought this would happen in a million years. The editors of High Times are in total ecstasy. As you can imagine, the people of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, who had turned to medical marijuana and pushing medical marijuana because their campaign for legalization for just recreational use failed. And so when they went in the direction of medical use and all these states started, you know, allowing it and passing laws governing it, then that was the little key they needed to get into the whole thing to get everybody thinking about legalization. So if you legalize it for medical use, that sort of takes the edge off of the drug thing, you know? I mean, it's just a drug like anything that you'd take, like an aspirin or something like that. And once that gets into the public consciousness, what has happened that the people now favoring the legalization of marijuana is over 50% of the United States population. That's never happened. It used to, it came from like 15 or 20% maybe 2 decades ago. So it's been massive, and for counterculture people, or at least people who grew up in the counterculture like I did a little bit, it's just wonderful.
Well, and I love this picture you have about the deep history of this plant too. I mean, you have a picture of a plant in an ancient botanical garden in Amsterdam, and this garden was even established in 1638. But of course, it's much longer term than that in terms of the use of this plant, especially by shamanic cultures in Mexico. I mean, it's got to be thousands of years.
Oh yeah. The plant is ancient, and it's been around a long time. It's been used in medicine, in Chinese medicine, for example, and Indian medicine. It's been around forever. I am not an expert on the medical applications of marijuana. I'm just an expert on growing it.
Right, which is what your book focuses on.
Yeah,
and I do want our listeners to know that this book is not theoretical. This is hands-on. I know our show hasn't been, because I figured, you know, you're not going to sit there and take notes from the radio show. Just to know the book exists, because you do talk about very specific stuff about lighting and watering and pruning and how to get the best crop and growing it either without seed or with seed or whatever it is that, you know, varieties that you might want to choose. And, you know, really, really a great practical guide.
And it's not technical at all. In other words, you don't have to worry about obscure language or phraseology that you'd have to have a degree in botany to understand. I'm not going in that direction. I'm just treating it like another house plant, another garden plant. Here's how you do it. It's no big deal. But you gotta be careful. And that's what
I'm
telling
you. You have that very much so in the books, in the front. You know, like you have all kinds of disclaimers about don't just do this and say the book said you could do it. You know, you have to make your own informed decision about your state laws. And interesting, because as you said, your book is already outdated and hopefully will continue to be even more so in terms of the states that are now allowing it.
Yeah, there's no way to. I mean, with states falling all over each other trying to get it legalized, I put the ones in there that were legal, and there were 14 of them, and I think it's up to 19.
Exactly. So, and this book is rather new. So, you know, that's happening quickly. And you do say that, too. You say that, you know, right now, as of the writing, as at this writing. So it's just a beautiful book. It's a great book. I bet it's doing really well.
It seems
people
to be.
People are looking for this information.
I like when my books sell well, because it makes me royalties.
Of course, all authors like that, but it's wonderful, just beautiful, and you have a great picture here of these terrible aphids, which can ruin, you know, it's just very, very detailed, and you even have some recipes in here. Uh-oh.
We do.
Mind-boggling
chocolate chip cookies. There's a lot of people who don't like to smoke. Some people can't smoke because of various lung problems that they have and so forth. So you can ingest it, but you have to do it carefully. And the old days of just throwing an unmeasured amount of marijuana into a brownie mix, that's way gone. Hopefully people don't do that, otherwise they could get in some trouble. I mean, the trouble is just when marijuana experience turns into an acid trip, and that's what you don't want.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this book. We're coming to the end of our show. I do want to tell our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Find out more by going to naturalnurse.com, and for more about this book, go to Dave, D-A-V-E, dash DeWitt, D-E-W-I-T-T, .com, and of course Amazon.com, growing medical marijuana securely and legally. Thank you so much for listening today to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com, and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Sampro. We both are wishing you the best and hoping that you stay healthy.